Bracelet of Hope's 10th Anniversary Summer Festival. Join us on Saturday, August 13th at Royal City Park at 139 Gordon Street from 12 p.m. to 7 p.m. for a great day of music, food trucks, and vendors. Celebrate our 10th anniversary with Sweet Temptations, Lucador, Faux Cheesy, Café du Monde, and Breakfast Blues Barbecue Food Trucks. We'll also have five bands performing, including Dave Archer, The Speakeasies, and Zoe and the Great Escape. Admission to the festival is free as a thank you to our community for supporting us for the past 10 years. Again, that's Bracelet of Hope's 10th Anniversary Summer Festival on August 13th from 12 to 7 p.m. at Royal City Park, a physically accessible venue. To volunteer, become a vendor, or for more information, please visit www.braceletofhope.ca or call 226-790-3824. Hope to see you there!
You're listening to Back in the USSR.
Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции. Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы. Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества. Ура!
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That, of course, was the Red Army with its the Soviet national anthem performed in Red Square in 1977 at the anniversary of the October Revolution. And of course, I am Siegfried. Welcome to show 4 show number four, where I'll be presenting once again about my book, Proletarian God, Building the Socialist Future. I've had three episodes so far talking about various aspects of that book. Once again, what I mean, of course, by proletarian God is the collective power that the working class has around the world as basically the builders of civilization, the creators of all wealth. You know, that's the foundation of civilization. We're going to be talking more about that today. And today actually is particularly appropriate, the subject which I have planned, which is about chapter 11 of my book. And that section of the book is actually on building the socialist economy. You know, it's on the economics of socialism. And perhaps this is most appropriate because, of course, now we see with the Brexit, with the vote by the British people to leave the European Union, we see a crisis of capitalism emerging. You know, when that happened, the markets plunged. You had all kinds of currency. You know, currencies went into an uproar, all kinds of financial speculation, all kinds of market turmoil, and all this kind of stuff, which was thrown into, you know, the capitalist system in Europe basically was thrown out of whack by what happened. You know, so of course, when things like that go on, we of course need to ask ourselves why. Why is this the situation? Why are people's livelihoods being thrown in jeopardy by the by market forces like this? And ultimately, is there an alternative to the system which treats people as commodities, treats people as expendable, and people as exploitable? The most fundamental question on how we build a socialist society, remember in my last episode, I was talking about the need to build a socialist state, to extend socialist political power around the world, working class political power around the world, in order to counteract capitalist globalization. Because, of course, the power of capitalism definitely is global. The power of the profit motive is global in this era of global markets and global trade flows and global empire. But the most fundamental question on how we build a socialist society has to do with the construction of a socialist economy. And indeed, it is on the question of how to build a viable post-capitalist economic system where the vast majority of progressive commentators, at least in this part of the world, fall short. The main reason for this is that they don't understand class, or they don't understand history. And they usually don't understand either of these things. So we get a lot of talk, really just about every election now. It's not just in the US election, it was in the Canadian election. We get a lot of talk about building a fair economy, an economy that works for everyone, an economy that can lead to shared prosperity and doesn't leave anyone behind, an economy that is rational and common sense. We've heard vague statements like these again and again. We heard them during the Occupy movement. We hear them now around the Bernie Sanders campaign. We heard some of that stuff coming from Justin Trudeau when he ran last year in the Canadian federal election. And regardless of who makes these statements, you know, it seems we hear them from just about all sides of the political spectrum these days. They fail to grasp the reality of capitalism and the nature of class struggle and the nature of class itself. This is what I say in the opening paragraph of chapter 11 of my book, where I discuss building the socialist economy. I say, the inequality of modern society can be seen in who gets what, when, and how. We must ask ourselves a fundamental question. Do we want an economy run by and for the wealthy investor, or by and for the working masses of the people? We cannot have both. It's either one or the other. A proletarian lives off of their own labor, while the capitalist lives off of the labor of others who work for them. And this is a fundamental difference that cannot be reconciled. Economic injustice begins as soon as one person has control over the labor of another and commands that labor for his or her own profit and private wealth accumulation. This power dynamic is at the root of economic exploitation and class conflict, whether it's in a slave-owning society of masters and slaves, a feudal society of lords and serfs, or a capitalist society in which capitalists exploit the labor of legions of proletarians for private gain. The only way that such exploitation can be defeated is through socialist economic democracy, empowering the working class to run its own affairs, understanding that all economic power is rooted in collective labor, and thus economic power belongs to proletarians alone. Economic justice will only be secured when the workers of the world take charge of their own destiny, and the primary function of the proletarian guard as an institution of the Universal Republic, and I talked about this last week, is to make this a reality on a global scale. And if you remember, the proletarian guard was actually the legislative body, the legislative arm of government in the worldwide federation of socialist states that I believe is necessary to counteract capitalist globalization. You know, when I go on to say that the underpinning of economics is the material survival of human beings, and there is one undeniable feature of modern economic life that capitalist economists have done their best to conceal: the irreplaceable presence of the global working class as the creators of economic value in the world. As Karl Marx, echoing Adam Smith, stressed in Das Kapital, iron rusts, wood rots. Living labor must seize on these things and change them from merely possible into real and effective use values. Working people are the builders of civilization. The houses, the monuments, the schools, the libraries, the temples, the roads, the aqueducts, the tools, the inventions, everything from the seven wonders of the ancient world to the CN Tower and the Golden Gate Bridge were created by the hand of the working class. Corporations and individual capitalists, by contrast, produce nothing. They are vehicles for the acquisition of profit and the systemic exploitation of proletarian labor to this end. In short, they are like gigantic parasites that suck the blood of working people and expropriate the fruits of their labor. And ultimately, if we're looking at the reasons why British working class people chose to leave the European Union, is they understood the European Union was an institution that basically sucked their blood, was a parasite, that put them at the mercy of free trade deals and foreign corporations and outsourcing and all that stuff, and basically making their livelihoods insecure and at the mercy of global creditors and industrialists and bankers and, you know, unelected bodies of politicians and bureaucrats based in Brussels and you name it. And it's true, there were sections of the Leave campaign that were incredibly racist and xenophobic. But there isn't evidence to really suggest that the majority of people who voted to leave did so for those reasons. You know, and you just have to see in the last British election how few British working class people actually did vote for right-wing racist forces like UKIP and other forces on the far right. They got actually little support. So the vast majority of these people are not doing it for racist reasons, pulling out of the EU. They're doing it because it's a force that basically is not accountable. It's not democratically under control. But it's something that can shape and dramatically alter the lives of working people. And it's a force that they cannot control. And they want to get out of that. They don't want to have that hanging over them. They don't want to have those kind of forces controlling their lives. You know, so even getting out of the EU, and of course it's a long, drawn-out process of renegotiation and all kinds of other shenanigans, but nonetheless, the vote to leave is an expression of the desire for self-determination against capitalism. And that's something that the people in Britain, the leftist forces in Britain, can tap into, and as indeed they should, indeed they must, if they truly want to fight against things like xenophobia and racism. They don't need the EU to do that. And in fact, the EU is part of the problem when it comes to that. And it's very important to understand what I'm talking about when I, in my book here, when I talk about building socialism. When we talk about working class self-determination, working class people asserting control over economy and society. I'm not talking about Bernie Sanders' plan to, quote, make America great again by restoring the American welfare state. You know, and that's effectively what a lot of his supporters believe. You know, it's not just Trump who's into the whole, like, red-blooded American restoring national values and what have you and all that nonsense. I'm also not talking about the fantasies of those leftists who decry Britain's decision to leave the EU and who claim that an undemocratic austerity-enforcing capitalist order can somehow be reformed in a socialist manner. And I'm not talking about Naomi Klein, Chris Hedges, David Suzuki, Noam Chomsky, or a million other intellectuals who go on and on about alternatives to capitalism that are neither that are either grounded in a serious misreading of the post-war welfare state in the West, or couched in utopian techno-fantasies of green economics, or an urban primitive revival of the village economy based on locally sourced products, just to name a few of the fantasies that they spread. What I am talking about is destroying the exploitative relationship by which the capitalist class extracts profit from the masses of working people on a global level, in building an economic order that puts working class people in control of their own lives and livelihoods. Say that again. In control of their own lives and livelihoods, free from the tyranny of market forces and the dictatorship of the profit motive that reigns in capitalist society. Socialism means proletarian class control over the economy and society, a society whose wealth is held collectively for the benefit of the people, rather than accumulated in a tiny minority of super wealthy hands. All of this has been done before, and it is largely the historical ignorance of modern day progressive thinkers that prevents them from seeing the solutions that are right there in front of them. If you want to understand how socialism works, and how it can work and be improved upon in the future, we have to look at the concrete historical experiences of actual socialist countries and societies, rather than dismissing them as Stalinist failures or some other nonsense term. In fact, in light of all this, I actually have I'm going to take my first kind of musical interlude here with a piece of music, which is actually a piece of Turkish folk music, which I believe kind of cuts the, which I want to really dedicate to all those leftists who are on kind of a wild goose chase, and have really been since the fall of the Soviet Union, a wild goose chase for a post-capitalist economy that denies the reality of actually existing socialism, the actual historical experiences of countries like Cuba, China, the USSR, Eastern European states, Nicaragua, all these places that have actually experienced and built socialism in the past. All those leftists who think we have to reinvent the wheel in order to somehow build a post-capitalist economic order. This is called the Dance of the Golden Hen. The Golden Hen in Turkish legend is something that you can never catch. It will lead you on a wild goose chase. You'll be chasing it forever. And that's the thing. We need to bring the discussion about alternatives to capitalism into the real world. We need to bring it into the realm of concrete historical experience, historical fact, evidence. You know, not on these kind of like wild speculations. We need to bring it into the real realm of history. Otherwise, we're just going to be chasing shadows forever and forever, and no alternative will emerge. So we can't be on wild goose chases. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR. You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was Group Aslar with the Dance of the Golden Hen, which is a piece of music from Turkish folklore, talking about a golden hen that nobody could catch, and everybody wanted to catch it. And people are chasing around trying to catch this golden hen. And of course, they can't get a grip on it. And really, that kind of was kind of the metaphor which I was kind of invoking as to how certain sections of the left deny the experience of history in the construction of socialism in various places around the world, deny the history of the USSR, deny the history of historical experience of in China or Vietnam or Cuba or wherever else, like people have actually, working class people have struggled to build actual alternatives to capitalism, actual societies and economies where working people have actually been able to enjoy the fruits of their labor, free from the tyranny of the profit motive and global capitalist forces and what have you. They deny. It's like they, in the aftermath of the Cold War, they think that whole historical experience is illegitimate or something. And that, of course, has really sabotaged the struggle against capitalism in a very big way. And that's really what I want to address today. As I go forward and talk more about this section of my book, Proletarian God, Building the Socialist Future. And I go on to say, popular discourse in the West, especially over the last 30 years or so, has reflected the class consciousness of the capitalist. The idea that greed is good and that private vices have public benefits has gained widespread acceptance. Even if they disagree that greed is good, there are many liberal and left-wing dreamers who long for a capitalism without capitalism, rejecting socialism and common ownership of economic resources with pipe dreams of sustainable development, green capitalism, and fair trade. Blind as they are to the exploitative class relationship inherent in the capitalist system, where economic power rests in the hands of an elite oligarchy and where the people grow more and more dependent on corporate power to provide them with even the most basic of goods and commodities. In the wake of the collapse of the Soviet Union, ideas of market socialism have become common parlance in left-wing circles, joining the chorus of contradictory ideas such as the capitalism without capitalist nonsense advanced by many social democrats, arguing that workers' control and capitalist market forces can be reconciled somehow. Unsurprisingly, most such arguments conveniently ignore or sidestep the question of whether labor markets and labor exploitation will continue to exist under such ignorant schemes, as logically they must. The only realistic alternative to capitalism can be found in the real history of socialist economic development. Socialist states and socialist economies brought development and prosperity to many lands in the 20th century and continue to raise millions of people out of poverty and want in the countries where socialism endures. The Soviet Union, as the world's first socialist state, remains an instructive example of what working class control over the means of production and the commanding heights of the economy and society can achieve. As Albert Szymanski has documented extensively, the USSR was a place where the needs of people came before the demand for profit. Writing in 1984, he states that, in traditional Marxist-Leninist terms, the Soviet Union is in a fairly advanced state of full socialism, making gradual progress in the transition to communism. Although it characterizes its state as a state of the whole people, this essentially amounts to a dictatorship of the proletariat, broadly defined, since the only other classes are the collective farm peasantry, ever smaller in size, and more like state farm workers in their conditions, and the intelligentsia, which officially is described as a stratum of the working class. All productive property of consequence has been socialized since the mid-1930s. State-owned property, coordinated through the central plan and managed without exploitation by working people, encompasses most of the economy. Since the 1930s, the principal mode of distinction has been according to labor, Although the social wage consisting of basic services has been growing in proportion as a proportion of all consumption, while income differences have been shrinking quite radically, distribution of the basis of need is coming to supplant distribution on the basis of labor contributed. The administration and technical division of labor is being slowly transcended with increasing automation, increasing skill levels, and growing participation in all levels of economic decision-making. In short, the Soviet Union was a society without exploitation, and this must be the goal of any serious fighter against capitalism and similar systems of class exploitation in the world. This basic socialist model must be taken up and improved upon in the 21st century and beyond if capitalism is to be overcome. Given the nature of the proletarian socialist political system that I propose and I have been describing, I described in the show last week, the socialist state will function as a popular force of working class power encompassing the entire working class. The socialist economy of the Universal Republic, and once again, the Universal Republic is the federation of socialist states that I'm proposing, in order to stand and defeat global capitalism. The socialist economy of the Universal Republic must take the form of a popular federation of the working class, a diverse array of collective and cooperative enterprises under the purview of a democratic political system of direct citizen participation and central planning. The local, regional, and national assemblies of the Proletarian Guard, the legislative body of the Universal Republic, must therefore be responsible for the economic planning and economic management in cooperation with the executive, in addition to the formulation of law. Through this process, the people will have direct oversight over the means of production, with the goal of creating conditions where free human beings will collectively organize the production and distribution of goods in accordance with real needs, as democratically expressed by the people themselves. Buying, selling, and manufacturing will thus be under democratic control, and the enterprises that develop, produce, and sell will be managed according to the will of the people as embodied by the socialist state. The working class shall dominate society as an empowered citizenry and as the empowered workers of collective enterprises. This will have the effect, in Friedrich Engels' words, of emancipating society at large from all exploitation, class distinctions, and class struggles. The working class built civilization and is therefore the rightful owner of civilization. Any economic system that fails to recognize this fundamental truth can only be based on theft. And above all, the working class does not need entrepreneurial saviors. The working class, the people, can do it themselves. And that really is the basis of socialism. Declaring emancipation from the profit motive and understanding that working class people collectively can build prosperity themselves. With their own hands. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Oh. You could look at any existing socialist country, if you don't want to call them socialists, call them whatever you want, post-capitalist, whatever, I don't care, call them camels, window shades, doesn't matter, as long as we know the countries we're talking about. You can look at any one of those countries, and you can evaluate them in several ways. One, comparing them to what they had before. And that, to me, is what's very compelling. That's what's so compelling about Cuba, for instance. When I was in Cuba, I was up in the Escambray, which is like the Appalachia of Cuba, very rugged mountains, the poor people, very poor, they were. And I said to this campesino, I said, do you like Fidel? And he said, si, with all our souls. I remember his gesture, with all our souls. I said, why? And he pointed to this clinic right up there on the hill, which we had visited. He said, look at that. He said, before the revolution, we never saw a doctor. If someone was seriously ill, it would take 20 people to carry that person, because you'd go day and night. It would take 2 days to get to the hospital. First, because it was far away, and second, because you couldn't go straight. You couldn't cross the latifundio lands. The boss would kill you, so you had to go like this. And often when we got to the hospital, the person might be dead by the time we got there. Now we have this clinic up here with a full-time doctor. And today, a doctor in Cuba, when you become a doctor, you've got to spend 2 years out in the country. That's your dedication to the people. And a dentist who comes one day a week. And for more serious things, we're not more than 20 minutes away from a larger hospital. That's in the Escambray. He said, that's freedom. We're freer today. We have more life. And I talked to a guy in Havana who says to me, before, all I used to see here in Havana, you call this drab and dull. We see it as a cleaner city. It's true, you got the paint is peeling off the walls, but you don't see kids begging in the streets anymore, and you don't see prostitutes. Always there was prostitutes. Prostitution used to be one of the biggest industries. And today, this man is going to night school. He said, I can read. I can read. Do you know what it means to be able to read? Do you know what it means to be able not to read? I remember when I gave my book to my father, I dedicated a book of mine, Power and the Powerless, to my father. I said, to my father with my love. Gave him a copy of the book. He opened it up, looked at that. He'd only gone to the seventh grade. He was a son of an immigrant, a working class Italian. And he opens the book and he starts looking through it and he gets misty-eyed, very misty-eyed. And I thought it was because he was so touched that his son had dedicated a book to him. That wasn't the reason. He looks up to me and says, I can't read this, kid. I said, that's okay, Dad. Neither can the students. I mean, that's not something. I mean, don't worry about that. I wrote it for you. I mean, it's your book, and you don't have to read it. You know, it's a very complicated book, academic book. He says, yeah, I can't read this book. And the defeat that man felt. That's what illiteracy is about. That's what the joy of literacy programs is. That's why in Nicaragua you got people walking proud now for the first time. They were animals before. They weren't allowed to read. They weren't taught to read. So you compare a country to what it came from with all its imperfections. And those who demand instant perfection, the day after the revolution, they get up and say, are there civil liberties for the fascists? Are they going to be allowed to have their newspapers and their radio program? Are they going to be able to keep all their farms? The passion that some of our liberals feel, the day after the revolution, the passion and concern they feel for the fascists, the civil rights and civil liberties of those fascists who were dumping and destroying and murdering people before. Now the revolution has got to be perfect. It's got to be flawless. Well, that isn't my criteria. My criteria is what happens to those people who couldn't read. What happens to those babies that couldn't eat, that died of hunger? And there, that's why I support revolution. The revolution that feeds the children gets my support. Not blindly, not unqualifiedly. And the Reaganite government that tries to stop that kind of process, that tries to keep those people in poverty and illiteracy and hunger, that gets my undiluted animosity and opposition.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU, that was Michael Parenti's clip from a talk which he gave in 1986, a talk where he talks about the Cuban Revolution and really what the construction of socialism brought to the Cuban people. And before that, we had it's actually quite a rare Red Army Choir song, which was done in the 1930s. It's called Capital Oppresses Us. You know, this Soviet anti-capitalist song. And it's very important to understand, you know, the construction of socialism, what we're moving against, what we're really trying to do is really emancipate working people, give them control over their own lives, make it so that, you know, they are not at the mercy of market forces. You know, all these kind of forces imposing on them, you know, making use of them, you know, exploiting them. You know, making sure their life, you know, making it so that their life is not their own. You know, always beholden to the boss, always beholden to the, you know, to the owners of capital, always beholden to, you know, international, you know, multinational corporations, you know, and what have you. Socialism puts working class people in control of their lives and their communities and ultimately their countries and their nations. The Soviet Union was the first society in human history to organize itself on the basis of public ownership of the means of production and coordinated economic planning. It was the first society to really build an alternative to capitalism and market forces. Over the more than seven decades of its existence, and in the face of all manner of obstacles, it succeeded in socializing private property, protecting the revolution and the gains of working people, achieving the rapid electrification and industrialization of a formerly impoverished country, building universal public education, public health care, housing, and developing and empowering even the most impoverished and oppressed regions of the former Russian Empire. These massive achievements were won not through market mechanisms, corporate takeovers, or the plunder of third world resources and labor, but through the strength of the socialist state itself and the efforts of people who were consciously building a new society for themselves and their children. It is through their victories that the lies of capitalist propaganda are exposed for what they are, and the true power of working class self-determination becomes clear. How, wherever it emerged, and whenever it emerged, socialism put power into the hands of proletarians. The Chinese Cultural Revolution, which is true, it's a controversial time. Even now in China, there's like different camps, and certain people think it was really great, other people think it was absolutely terrible, time of chaos. But the Chinese, during the Chinese Cultural Revolution between 1966 and 1976, that revolution succeeded in dramatically increasing agricultural productivity, industrial output, and technological innovation because, quote, it gave ordinary villagers a voice in production decisions, encouraged local initiative, and compelled cadres to work together with ordinary farmers, creating political conditions in which villagers were empowered within the collective structure of the overall economy. And I say, real economic efficiency, building on this example, real economic efficiency is only possible when people have control over their own lives, their own destiny, and possess a personal stake in the success of an economic enterprise. When people identify themselves with something, when they feel that they have a stake in something, this is when they will work hard. Fundamentally, people work the hardest not when their wages are the highest, not out of self-interest or profit, not even out of survival. People work the hardest when they work for a common cause that inspires them and in which they believe. In short, when their social nature is appealed to as human beings. One Soviet worker, Varlam Shalimov, described the enthusiasm that he and millions of other people in Russia and around the world felt for the socialist cause. Quote, what horizons, what vast prospects opened up to everyone, to the most ordinary of men. End quote. As they worked together to build a new future that they could believe in and where they could fulfill themselves as human beings in every respect, which is something capitalism had denied them before. You know, they had to work for their own survival. You know, here they could actually develop themselves. They weren't always working for survival and just to, you know, get by and make ends meet. The fact that people came from around the world and went to the USSR, studied at its universities and worked there, proves, even if some of them came away disillusioned, that people will support a cause, work for a cause, and lend their talents to a cause for reasons other than the profit motive. Jean-Marie Chauvet describes how many of the great Soviet industrial achievements of the 1950s and 60s were made possible by, quote, young people who were not militants, anti-establishment, or party officials, just eager to live life to the fullest, and who left the comforts of city life for the major construction sites of the 1950s and 60s, attracted by the romance or the financial incentives. The construction of Academic City in Novosibirsk, the power stations on the Siberian rivers, the industrial complexes at Togliatti and on the Kama River, and the second Trans-Siberian Railway, the BAM, have left them remembering their youth as a period when they lived life intensely, despite the current widespread feeling that it was all a huge mess. People work hard when they believe, if they believe in something, are recognized for the job that they do, are respected for it, and are democratically empowered to have control over the means of production in society. It follows that in socialist society is dominated by the producers of wealth, and not those who live off the wealth of others. And not those who live off the wealth of others. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR. Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU, that was the Chinese, the Choir of the People's Liberation Army, China, and it was called Ode to the Motherland. And this really kind of feeds into what we were talking about here with the socialist economy and building, and people having a real sense of ownership over their country, and the development, economic development under socialism being this kind of collective thing, people feel they're a part of. They feel they're a part of it. This belongs to them. And they all can feel proud. You know, they're building prosperity. They're building shared prosperity in society with their own hands, with their own labor. You know, you get that in a socialist economy. You don't get that in a capitalist society where, of course, you know, where workers are exploited and they end up, you know, they basically are alienated and don't have any control over their means of production, over what is produced and when and how, and the kind of projects that go through, you know, basically economic development in general. They don't have control over it, but in socialism they do. Partisans of capitalism despise socialists for supposedly leeching off the state and being parasitical in their dependence on others. This seems rather bizarre when you consider that countries like socialist East Germany, Deutsche Demokratische Republik, the DDR, were more self-sufficient in the production of machinery, electronics, automobiles than the United States has probably ever been, and were hardly leeching off of anyone. Even in March 1989, when most European socialist countries were entering economic crises after adopting pro-capitalist reforms, East Germany, which had fully retained the socialist economic model, was going from strength to strength, having achieved such efficiency in it that its economy was recycling almost half of its waste materials. We see in the Soviet Union, though a besieged pariah state for most of its history, managed to raise more people out of poverty than any other state in the world has ever done in a matter of decades, and it did so largely by itself. And similar things could be said about China. You know, the economic takeoff which has occurred in recent decades would not have been possible, you know, without the intense economic development, you know, using really domestic resources and the labor power of Chinese workers and peasants, you know, that was done in the 1960s and 1970s. You know, where you had all kinds of strides being made in medicine, aeronautics, nuclear power, satellite technology, mass transit, natural resource extraction, agriculture, and computers. And this is before China even opened its doors to foreign investment. And already they were developing at an unprecedented scale. You know, and achieving all kinds of things in all kinds of development in a society that was recovering from decades of civil war and foreign invasion. But perhaps the most dramatic example of socialist self-reliance is Cuba, which faced economic disaster at the beginning of the 1990s as the collapse of the Soviet Union as its main trade partner, combined with the ongoing American embargo, brought the small island nation to the brink of starvation. Despite facing colossal challenges, Cuba's socialist economy was able to mobilize in the name of national survival. And agriculture in particular was totally reoriented from cash crops to food production, pioneering urban agriculture and ecologically sustainable production techniques. In the space of a few years, because of soaring domestic production, Cuba had completely overcome the crisis, restored its people's calorie consumption to normal levels, and demonstrated the resilience of socialism as an economic system. And Cuba continues to make impressive strides in medical research, agricultural production, and renewable energies, initiating what can only be described as a crash program in solar, wind, and biomass energy production to break the country's traditional reliance on imported fuel. The nation's health indicators, life expectancy, human development levels, and poverty eradication continue to astound global observers. You know, this is a society that's under siege. And it's still making all kinds of achievements. And to give a particularly illustrative example, Cuba's state-owned BioCuba Pharma, biotechnology and pharmaceutical industry group, is now a world leader. It's a world leader in medical technology, consisting of 32 entities, 78 production facilities, and almost 22,000 workers. While it manufactures 8 medicines, and 578 of the 857 treatments which make up the country's basic catalog of medicines. The industry's biotechnological resources are combined with services, attributes, and technological platforms managed by a highly trained staff, which includes 6,325 university graduates, 262 doctors, and 1,170 Masters of Science graduates, 1,300 technicians, and 719 researchers. The consortium has attained great strides in developing comprehensive care for diabetic patients, diagnosis and rehabilitation of cardiovascular illnesses and cancer prevention, research and treatment features And other projects include the detection, analysis, and treatment of hearing disabilities, early identification of neurodevelopment disorders in infants, comprehensive pre- and neonatal research, and epidemiological surveillance. It's existed for 50 years now. It has joint enterprises abroad in Brazil, Venezuela, South Africa, India, Vietnam, and Algeria, and attributes its success to the country's highly skilled professionals and the central aim of ensuring the population's health as an integrated component of a socialist economy where the needs of the people are of paramount importance. So that's Cuba. It's a tiny island nation. That's the kind of gains that it's made. And this is the truth. Revolutionary socialism, whether in Eastern Europe, China, Russia, Cuba, Southeast Asia, or Korea, created a life which for the great mass of people was far better than the wretched existence that they had endured under feudal lords, military bosses, foreign colonizers, and Western capitalists. Indeed, hundreds of millions were lifted out of poverty by socialism on a scale which has never been equaled before or since. As the world's first socialist state, the Soviet Union achieved an unprecedented level of equality, security, healthcare, housing, education, and culture for its citizens, progressing from a semi-feudal and semi-colonial society to a modern economy capable of rivaling the United States in industrial and agricultural output. There is no reason why we cannot learn from the past in order to ensure that socialism works even better in the future, building on its already undeniable achievements. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Y que cualquier hombre pueda gritar. matar sus propias esperanzas, sus heridas y sus